everybody, and welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have a fab boo guest for us today. His name is Steve Hayes, and he has a YouTube classic movie review show called Tired Old Queen at the Movies. This song has been going through my head all day, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? I'm so pleased to be on the show. It's great.
I am so excited you're on the show. And you know, guys, how I got Steve is because of the wonderful Mark Griffin, who was on and talked about Rock Hudson in his book. And I was thrilled because I wanted to get you on. And for some reason, I don't know, you weren't getting my stuff, or perhaps you were shunning me. I don't know.
Oh, shunning you. Yes, I can really afford to shun anyone. The only person I shun is myself, and I do it every morning when I look in the mirror.
Oh, you look great.
I go, Dad, I thought you were in Florida.
You look good. I mean, where'd you come up with Tired Old Queen at the Movies? I love it.
But I have this friend of mine who's been my mentor for years, and his name is Vince Cardinal, and he said to me, you know, I think you should be a household name. And I said, well, because I've been doing comedy and running around town and being an actor for years and years in New York. And I said, well, what's your idea? He said, I think we should come into your wild apartment and hand you a DVD and have you talk off the top of your head about a classic movie, just like you do at every dinner party you go to, and we'll do it one a month. And what do you want to call it? And I said, let's call it what it is, Tired Old Queen at the Movies.
I love it.
I said, so if anybody else calls me that, it doesn't hurt because I've already done it myself. I'm quite aware. So that's how we got it.
I think you're adorable. I really do. I think you're handsome. I do.
Oh, I'll give you an hour to cut that out. Thank you. How nice.
I do. But I love them, and I love your reviews. You crack me up. And
oh, thank you.
We are together basically because we have a Mona Plash from All That Heaven Allows.
Oh, Mona.
Love-a-thon.
I love Mona Plash. Jacqueline DeWitt. Oh, my God. That actress, she cracks me up.
She is wonderful.
Oh, my God. And she's so huge. You know, Douglas Sirkin, those movies are always a little eccentric and over the top. And then she walks in, and it's like she's like a cartoon. She's fabulous. Perfect. You know, and why? Hello, Sarah. I think you have an naughty mind.
Oh, yes.
Mention Carrie? Well, really?
So few widows would be wearing red, but I guess I don't remember that red. But when Carrie wore the red dress for the old Conrad Nagel,
Carrie looks so wonderful. I'm surprised more widows don't wear red, but then I guess you'd have to, wouldn't you, Carrie?
Me, ouch.
She is the best, and poor Agnes Moorehead. Why, your gardener? Mona will have a field day.
You know what cracks me up? What cracks me up about this Agnes Moorehead role is she's supposed to be Carrie's best friend, so she comes running because she heard from Mona Plash, and she said, "Carrie, I heard from Mona Plash." And I didn't believe her for a minute that you were dating your gardener. And she's,
well, you should.
Well, you should. Oh, Carrie.
Your gardener? Oh. And they'll say that was going on before.
Yeah.
Before your husband even died.
But she was so funny because she's being Mona Plash. She's saying what Mona Plash is going to say, but she's saying what she feels. She said, they'll say he's younger than you. I don't care. Yes. They'll say he's after your money.
Yes.
He's not.
And, you know, it's one of those times, too, you know, when they did that when they did that beautiful homage to that movie, you know, Far From Heaven.
Yes.
And Patricia Clarkson played that part. They were brave enough to really go all the way with that part. That Patricia Clarkson drops her because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought that was very interesting. You know, they have him stick by when he was a younger man, but when it was an Afro-American man, she dropped Julianne Moore, which I thought was really interesting. That was when I reviewed All That Heaven Allows, I did it simultaneously
yes.
with Far From Heaven because he did such a beautiful homage to that movie.
He really
almost shot for shot, and it was. You know, I have a real soft spot for Douglas Sirk films. I love them. I love I absolutely love Dorothy Malone and Written on the Wind. It's one of my favorites. I have I have whole discussions about this, about that, Will, but you know, the way she just, you know, the way she is, she's so bitchy. After everything she says, you'll like, you'll say, where are they going? I don't know. Where would you go with your best friend's wife? You're a filthy liar. I'm filthy, period. Just try keeping your mouth and your eyes open. Oh, she's so great.
I love her.
After your marriage, well, you have my condolences.
What a trollop. And all she wants is rock.
Oh, rock. And the best thing about that is the vividness of the color.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a hot pink dress on, and she drives a red Jaguar with that blonde hair. And Dorothy Malone had the saddest eyes in the business. She really did. She had, her eyes were always so sad. You know, big, beautiful blue eyes. She mesmerized me. I loved her. She just died. I think they're going to probably do a memorial tour at this week's.
When did she die?
The memorial. She died in the summer. She was 93 or 94.
Wow.
Yeah, she lived a long time. Yeah.
Well, look at Kirk Douglas. He's like 103. Marsha Hunt's still alive.
Well, don't tell him. He may not know.
Yeah. Olivia de Havilland's still one tough broad,
still a steel butterfly.
She is unbelievable because she went to the Supreme Court about Feud.
Well, you know, they should have taken more care with her. You know, this, people forget that she was the woman that broke the 7-year contract system. She took him to court. There is in Congress, there is the de Havilland decision. And she made the studios, she went, took them to court until they had to break it. They couldn't automatically tack on time for you at the end because you'd been on suspension and things. And Betty tried to break it, and Cagney, and they never got it, but she did.
She's a tough broad.
She changed how, the whole thing for actors forever with that decision. And I think that, you know, she was a fighter. She wasn't going to let that anybody, you know, say anything about her. I think they were foolish not to approach her lawyers or approach her that they were going to do this. That was a foolish thing on their part. Even if they didn't win, even if she didn't win, you know, you owe somebody the grace. Just because they're elderly doesn't mean they're all completely out to lunch, you know?
Please. No, she's certainly not. She really
isn't. She's certainly not. And, you know, she's tough. She's tough. Like all those girls, you know, they were tough. They had to be. They had to fight against men. They had to.
But the funny part is that she has this whole, you know, persona that she wasn't really a tough broad. You know, her.
Well, all of them did. I mean, they were never. You know, of course, if you study these things for long, if you're as obsessive about it as you and I are, you really know that the people are. That's their product. They are nothing like their product. You know, the only person to me who had an idea of what that was all about was Dietrich. She always referred to herself as, Dietrich wouldn't do that. Dietrich wouldn't do this.
And the third person.
They knew. Yeah, they knew that the person was different from the product. That was the image. Cary Grant would, you know, said, you know, I wish I was Cary Grant. Everybody wants to wake up and be Cary Grant. I wish I was Cary Grant. You know, Rita Hayworth, you know, they take Rita Hayworth to bed and they wake up with me. You know, I mean, that was always the problem.
Yes.
And these people came, many of them came from really poverty-stricken backgrounds.
Archie Leach? Oh, my.
Archie Leach, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. It was just a really hard time. So I just want to start right now by asking you, because I am an obsessed, and I read all biographies, even when my sister taught me basically to read gossip rags when I was about 5. So when I was in first grade, I could read a Rona Barrett. I could read everything. And it wasn't C-Spot Run, Dick and Jane Go Up the Hill, nothing. I was reading torrid romances and things like that.
Sure, you were reading about Liz and Dick.
I love them.
And dumping him for Eddie and, oh, God, all that stuff that was in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, I was.
You're probably much younger than I am. When I was a kid, the main people were on the front of things were either Elizabeth Taylor or Jackie Onassis. For a while, it was Marilyn, and then Marilyn died, and then it was Doris Day and Rock Hudson. But then Elizabeth Taylor, hit Cleopatra and Richard Burton. And the whole thing leading up to that, that whole Debbie Reynolds, Eddie Fisher thing.
I love that. Yeah. And they were, like, condemned by the Vatican. And you know Eddie Fisher's a big old wimp. I read his book, though, and he was really kind of, he was kind of brutal, actually, and very, you know, to Debbie, saying that she had, like, her gym teacher friend was her lesbian lover and that she stunk in bed. And he was so mean.
Well, he was a nothing. You know, I mean, I always felt sorry, but I don't know. He must have had something going for him because the women, he was like catnip to certain women for some reason, and I never got it.
I cannot get it.
But I think she, I think he got Liz on the rebound.
Definitely, know? And because he was,
and what? She was so torn up because she had just been with Mike Todd, and Mike Todd, if you notice, Burton looked a lot like Mike Todd. On a rougher version, same sort of build, same sort of guy, same sort of, you know, and he just lusted after her. And she had, you know, Mike Todd was a, you know, he really wooed her and babied her and did everything. And then she was crushed when that happened. And I always thought she was so brave to keep going on in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof when that had happened, you know. Anyway. So what you want to, you said you wanted to start with how did I get my love?
So into, yeah, classic movies, the actors, the actresses.
Well, you know, my generation, I was born in 1953. My generation, we're like the first generation that were, that parents used the TV to babysit them. So my mother would turn on the television and sit me down, and I would watch these, I would watch things. And my childhood, my mother was an actress without a stage. She was over the top. Our days had Warner Brothers melodrama over every day. So when I would watch, like, Susan Hayward, who kind of looked like my mother at that time, I just thought that that was real. I that was how I had so much high melodrama. And my mother always spoke in cliches, and they were always like movie dialogue to me. So I just became obsessed. And they had, I was grew up in a small town outside of Syracuse, New York. And there were basically three channels, and they all had their own local movie programs every day. And they were running all the movies from the 40s. And then there was NBC Saturday Night at the Movies in the early 60s, which ran all of the Technicolor movies from the 50s. So that's where I saw Marilyn Monroe, and that's where I saw Susan Hayward, and that's where I saw, you know, Victor Mature, or all those big guys that were, or, you know, Charlton Heston, all those big hero guys.
Yeah.
And I just got into it, and I was obsessed with, I was hyperactive, so I was obsessed with, every Sunday they would run all the Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies, and I loved them.
He was such a punk. What a bob.
Oh, he was gorgeous. And those are still, I mean, Grant, they're not politically correct now by in any way,
no.
shape, or manner. But action-wise, they are some of the most incredible adventure movies you'll ever see, especially the early ones at MGM where they sunk big budgets into them.
Well, I loved the first Tarzan and the second Tarzan.
Tarzan and his mate and Tarzan, yeah. They were really good. Well, they were good right up until, right up until the early 40s. They were really good. But I kept watching them. Even when they moved them to RKO, I still loved it. I was a loyal Johnny Weissmuller guy. But I just loved them, and that's how I got into them. And I grew up in farm country in a small town with all farmland around it. And when we played all the movies, whatever movie I had just seen was what we would play. So that led me into being an actor, everything else. But that's how it happened. And I never lost my love of classic films. I still haven't. I never have lost it.
Mine's only grown. You know, I still...
Oh, yes.
Because I know so much more, and especially during the podcast.
Yes. And people contribute. You find out what other people were watching and what they liked, and you learn from them. It's a fabulous thing. I found that with Tidal Queen of the Movies, people come up and they go, oh, my God, I love this. And they say, people used to say to me, how can you watch a classic movie over and over again? I said, I see different things every time I watch it.
I do, too.
Sometimes I just watch it for the music. Sometimes I watch it for the cinematography, the direction, a particular actor's performance. I watch it for all sorts of different angles.
I do, too. I watch it for continuity, like in one scene, the shirt is nice and dry, and then there's a big armpit stain. It's like, because I watch all these things, too, and I'm like, my God, you know, what's wrong with these people? You know, don't they notice that his underarms and Joan Crawford's were sweating one time in a very early movie, and I can't imagine her having her.
Well,
ear.
You know, now that's a different angle. See, you watch that stuff. I don't watch that stuff. What I watch is, how did they photograph her? Why did they use that particular lighting? Why did they angle the camera at that direction coming in on that? I began noticing that particularly. I became obsessed with Bette Davis, and I would watch her. My three favorite movies of hers are the ones she did with Wyler, you know, Jezebel, The Letter, and The Little Foxes, and I would watch how he photographed her. And she wasn't an easy woman to photograph, and he would just find the most incredibly dramatic angles to photograph her from. And that's when I became obsessed with telling the story, even beyond just simply telling the story, letting the atmosphere, letting the cinematography, how did they, you know, yes, they were talking pictures, but they still had learned so much from silent films, and they were bringing that along. And then I began watching film noir, and that's my favorite genre. And I began reading about the German directors who'd escaped the Nazis and come over, and what they had learned at UFA, and how that influenced all their films, and the great cinematographers like Nicholas Piscara, who, you know, did a lot of those guys started with Val Lewton, and then they started making movies on their own, like Siad Mack and Jacques Tourneur and all those people. That just fascinated me, because it's a teamwork. It isn't only, you know, Hitchcock always loved to put his name above everything else and pretend to ignore everybody else, but you cannot do that. It's all teamwork.
Definitely.
You know?
That's the way it all gets made. You put it all together. And
that's
behind
right.
the scenes,
right.
guys, with the editing and the cinematography is very important.
Oh my God! And you know, I just directed a play up in Syracuse, and whenever I go and act in a play or direct a play, I always take classic movies and I have a movie night, and I'll show whoever wants to come can watch. And I rewatched The Little Foxes, and I said to them, look at how this is photographed. I said, Greg Toland had just come off directing Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. And you can see the direct influence that Welles had on Greg Toland's cinematography in Little Foxes, because it's so claustrophobic, and the ceilings on the sets and the way he photographs her, it's sensational.
It is claustrophobic, you're correct. It's
it
just
is.
Like this little life and everybody in it. I was going to ask you this one question if I can remember. And I can't.
Why? What do you mean you can't?
I can't remember.
Can't remember? Oh, that's because I babble too much.
Well, you know, babble, babble, babble.
Babble, 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 babble.
Well, that's from the women. Babble, babble, babble. You know how these creatures
yes, I
are.
Know.
Sylvia.
You know the how those women are. Babble, 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 babble. Look at this stuff. Oh, it's fine for the country, but really.
I love that movie, too. And it's so funny how she played, you know, before she did My Girl Friday and the women, she played this upper crust kind of poo-poo fa-fa-do lady.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, she was MGM's second string Myrna Loy.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that. She said, I would go in there and I would be, you know, I was trying to take a man away from Jean Harlow. She said, are you kidding? No man ever took, and she was the most gorgeous thing you ever laid your eyes on. She said, nobody ever took a man away from Jean Harlow, but there I was, you know, doing my stuff. And then, you know, she would get loaned out to other studios and they would take more chances with her, like Craig's wife. She went to Columbia.
Yes.
Craig's wife.
With that horrible John Bowles. Do you like him?
Yes. Oh, was he? Oh, my God. You could snore through that guy.
Yeah.
And then she did The Citadel in England. She went to England to do The Citadel with Robert Donat. And, you know, gradually she had to audition. I read she had to audition six different times for Q-Corps for the women because he didn't believe she could do comedy. And the last one was the most outrageous. And he said, that's the one I want.
Chomp and gum said, and...
Yeah. Yeah. And she said, are you kidding me? Joan Crawford and Norma Shearer will eat me alive. He said, that's fine. A little competition will up their game. you know. And everybody in that film, the timing is hysterical. You know, the casting of that, Mary Boland is so hysterical in that movie.
L'Amour. Yes, yeah, Buck Winston.
Yeah.
She was great. Yeah. Lucille Watson played Mary's mom, right?
Yes.
Did you?
No, my dad. I know my sex.
Yes. Did you ever see in the beginning, because I got to say, Norma Shearer gets into it, and I don't know what actor said it. They gave it to Robert Montgomery or the guy who played the, what's his name, Neil something. He was in a lot of movies, and then he became the kid. Commissioner in Batman.
But Neil Hamilton.
Right. And they said
Neil Hamilton was a great beauty. He in the 20s, he looked like a Leyendecker man. You know J.C. Leyendecker, who did the Arrow shirt men?
Yes.
That's who Neil Hamilton looked like. He was like a walking version of those guys. He was gorgeous.
He was very cute. And one of them said, you know, Norma gave her all with her love scenes. And you could tell she did. And they were wondering, you know, is she getting anything at home or something like that? Because she did. You know, I love Norma Shearer. I think she's fun.
Yeah, I did too. You know who else did that, surprisingly, gave her all in love scenes, was Loretta Young. Loretta Young, when she kisses somebody in a movie, oh, my God, they've been kissed. She really did it. You watch her. I love to watch her in romantic scenes. She got right into it. She was great. And Norma Shearer had the most difficult role in the women, because that role could have so easily gone, you know, sappy over the side.
Total
and
goody
she really
two-shoes
makes you
lady.
Like,
yes.
Yeah. She makes you genuinely like her and her journey. And you have to like Mary Haynes, because you've got to follow her journey and her arc. And she's everybody else is a supporting character, and most of them never change. They stay one way from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie. But she changes. She comes around. And you have to, if you're not interested in her arc, you're not going to watch the film. You know, you're going to lose. They're going to lose. And Cukor never does that. He reined her in. He knew exactly, and she knew exactly what she was doing, you know, to carry that. So
she was a really great actress. I liked her a lot, and I think she's underrated. I totally believe it.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people poo-pooed her, as always, and Joan Crawford being one of them.
Jealous.
Always poo-pooed Norman. Well, she was married to Irving Salberg, and that's the only reason she got those, you know, parts. No, the reason she got those parts is she was so good at what she did.
But
she
silent movies. Being married to Irving Thalberg didn't hurt. Let's face it.
Oh God, no! But you know, who could blame her? Come on, you know, everybody wants to move up. You know, she was no dummy.
Of course.
No. Well, they were very elegant.
They didn't want her for the divorcee because they didn't think she could be hot, and she had pictures taken of herself. She was fab in that.
Norma was smart. Norma was the first person to hire George Hurrell and knew what Hurrell could do for her. And she was the first person to start sending out publicity photographs by Hurrell on herself. Then Joan Crawford picked that up. And I read somewhere that Joan Crawford, in the course of her career, did over 2,000 separate sittings of photographs. Yeah. And I went it was back in the 90s. The Swan Gallery down in New York had an auction of two big lots of people who had passed away and had been bought just oodles of stuff at the Crawford auction, at the original Crawford auction. So I went down in a blinding blizzard with this friend of mine who was an avid Crawford fan like I am. It took us forever to get down there, and I remember we trudged through the snow. We opened up the door, and it was, I'm telling you, Craig, it was just like when Judy Garland opens up the door to The Wizard of Oz, everything was hanging there. She had all these dresses, everything. It was all Joan Crawford stuff. Her personal stuff, she kept her movie costumes. We looked across, and it was so filled with, with gay men. I haven't seen that many gay men since the convention. convention for a Bette Midler concert. Unbelievable. And we walked in there, and my friend Sharon and I looked across the room, and they're hanging on this. On this hanger was Joan Crawford's gardening dress from
Was
Whitley.
It wire?
It was, I don't remember. No, it wasn't a wire hanger, no. But it was hanging there in perfect condition, and we said, and simultaneously we pointed and we went, "When ladies meet!" And this gay guy turned around and looked at us and said, "I'm so glad you found each other." And this auction had each one of her movies had a separate sterling silver photograph album with written in her hand the name of the movie and the 100 original best stills from each of those movies.
This was for sale, or was it just like a museum-y kind of thing?
They were all auctioned. It was all auctioned off.
Who got the dough for it?
You can find the dough for it. There are plenty. Are you kidding me?
Oh, no, I mean, who actually benefited from the auction?
I don't know. And I don't know. I had a theory at one time about what these things were, but I didn't investigate it too much. I was just too glad to see all the stuff. I mean, there were boxes. There was a box of, like, Polaroid pictures. And every party that Joan Crawford had at her house, she had somebody at the door take a picture of all the guests that walked through the door at her party.
I would have been in heaven there.
You would have plotzed. I thought I was going to pass out. I couldn't believe how much great stuff it was. It was just amazing. And it was the whole thing, nothing but Joan Crawford. You know that? You know, in Straight Jacket, the marble statue of her.
Yes.
That was there. That was on sale there.
I wonder how much...
You wouldn't have believed it.
I wonder how much sold.
Oh, I don't know. It must have all sold. Then they had her false eyelashes. They had her matches. And her fans had sent her things. There was a decoupaged coffee table with nothing but her images decoupaged on a hardwood coffee table that she had. There was a clock that had her face and the arms went around her nose. It was just outrageous. She kept everything. And every single dress had lead weights in the hems. So no matter how she walked, they always fell correctly.
I never heard that. I know.
Yeah. Yeah, so she always, her dresses never wrinkled. They always looked fabulous. She had little lead weights sewed into the hems of all of her dresses.
And her shoulder pads.
Oh, yeah. And some of these things, I mean, the only other person that I had read about that had this kind of collection of stuff was Dietrich. When Dietrich died, she had over 50 huge storage units around the country filled with her costumes and stuff. And they all went to that museum in Berlin. In Berlin. They're all in Berlin now, Grace.
I would have loved to have seen Ma Wayne's stuff. She was so fabulous.
Ma Wayne? I loved her.
I did, too. She was so stunning and cool. I talked to one of my guests on the show was Meredith Ponadel, and her aunt Dottie was one. She was the first makeup artist female in any of the studios in the 30s.
Wow.
And she got into the union, and she knew everyone.
Was that Dottie Ponzel?
Yes.
Her name Dottie Ponzel. Dorothy, yeah, Dottie Ponzel, sure.
Yeah, so what a great book she read, and she was real, wrote, and what a great interview. Plus, I want to tell you with your film noir, I had Eddie Mullen on. I adore
Eddie Mullen. Isn't he nice?
I adore him.
Yes, I do too. I respect him a lot. I love his book. I love his takes, and he really knows and loves his stuff, and he wants you, when he does his intros at TCM,
so
he
cute.
Wants you to love them as much as he does, and that really shows through, I think.
Yeah, well, he was picked up for another year. This is a funny thing. During my interview with Eddie, the TCM publicist was on a conference. She was listening through the whole thing. This was last year. Isn't that odd?
Yeah. Huh.
I don't know what that was about, but, you know, TCM, I guess, has to protect their brand. It was right after Me Too. I flirted terribly with Eddie, or wonderfully with Eddie.
Good for you.
It was a flirtathon, and we had so much fun. And I'm with you. You did a review, and I have just discovered this movie, Fallen Angel. I adore it.
One of my favorites. You know, there's, first of all, Linda Darnell. Oh my God, that was the movie that really she turned dark in Summer Storm the year before, and she did a movie called Summer Storm where she played a dark character. Up to then, she'd been the beautiful virgin opposite Tyrone Power and all those things, you know. And then Fallen Angel came out.
She was amazing.
She was amazing in that movie, and you know she hated Otto Preminger, but he really knew how to get the most out of her. And that movie is so wonderfully, wonderfully dark. It's just great. It's just great. And there's something about this. I think Preminger's most interesting films were his noir films. You know, Fallen Angel, Laura, Where the Sidewalk
Ends. Oh, I love Laura. Yes, wonderful films.
Yeah.
Oh, I love Angel Face too. What a great flick.
Oh yeah, they're dark. You know, you know, all those German guys, boy, they brought that dark side. You know, they all lost people in the war. They suffered a lot, and the world was not a pretty place, and they didn't necessarily have happy endings. You know. Even in Fallen Angel, you know, he drives off with Alice Faye, but you're thinking, oh my God, what she gets stuck with? You know,
exactly. And how will he live there with
after all
the
that,
sister and her and living in that small town? You know, it's just like one of those movies where you go, you know, the end.
Yeah, buy it. But you go, I don't know, even in Laura, you know, she's going to go off with this detective. They've got about as much in common as apples and eggs, you know. I mean, they don't have anything
but
in common.
She falls in love in 2 days.
They're pretty hot, so, you know, they'll make it in bed for a while, but that won't last very long. You know,
Laura fell in love with Dana Andrews in about 2 days. Okay, Mom.
Well, who wouldn't?
Oh, I love him. I
mean, he
adore
was so masculine.
Him.
I mean, Clifton Webb fell in love with Dana Andrews.
Did he? I don't blame him.
Who could blame him? You know, and my favorite character in that one is Judith Anderson. Judith Anderson in that powder room scene
is a lesson
in acting and she puts that makeup on and does that whole, you know, Laura, I understand Shelby. Why? Because he's rotten. I know he's rotten. He knows I know he's rotten. He also knows that I don't care. And he puts on that lipstick. Oh, it's so great.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Dear, I didn't kill her, but I thought
but
of
I
it.
Thought about it.
So great.
God. And then as she's doing that, closes her purse, puts the net down on her hat, looks at herself one more time in the mirror and adjusts her hair in the back, and calmly walks out.
It is such a fabulous film. And Clifton Webb was, you couldn't have gotten anybody better than him.
Well, you know, and they wanted Laird Krieger for that part. And when Ruben Mamoulian had shot, I think, like a month on that movie, and Preminger was producing, and Zanuck didn't like Preminger. Preminger went in and he said, please, look at this. Look at this. It's terrible. It's terrible. So Zanuck watched the rushes and he said, there's no magic. Nothing's happening. Do you want me to fire him? And he said, please fire him. And he said, all right, but you're going to direct it. And if it flops, that's the end for you. And the first thing that Preminger did, he went in, he threw out all of that. He went to Zanuck. He said, first of all, I don't want to use Laird Krieger because everybody, after the lodge of ethics, everybody will know he's evil. He's always nasty. And Clifton Webb, he knew that because Clifton Webb was so flamingly gay that nobody would ever think he was in love with Laura. And that's why that worked.
It worked great.
It was a big surprise.
His thing was just sort of a possession of Laura, that he had created this person.
Course. He loved, it was just like his clock. She was a thing, a possession, just like his clock. He makes that very clear. These are my possessions. I want them back.
Well, especially his claw, because he had the shotgun in it.
Well, yeah. But also, you know, he wants the vase and he wants this thing. And, you know, it's a great. But Fallen Angels, everybody tried to play. They used the same team on Laura they used on Fallen Angels. Fallen Angels is a different story. And Fallen Angels is a small town siren. And she is the catalyst around that drives all these men crazy. And Linda Darnell, and it's so interesting to watch the effect that she has, and the fact that Charles Bickford is the guy that did it.
I love it though. What a great flick! And he was Everybody was wonderful in this. And
I'm so glad you liked it.
Oh,
I've been a big fan of that movie forever.
Adore it, and I do so love Danny Andrews. I adore him. And
he was so good. Solid actor.
Solid. So, and he played these parts so well. And I loved him as Fred Derry. I loved him in so many films. But
I thought he should have won the Oscar for Best Years of Our Lives.
So do I. So do I.
He really should have.
He never got nominated.
Terrific. Never. Never got a nomination. Which is so, I don't know, well. You know, the history of the Academy Awards is so strange anyway, and wonderful and upsetting and fabulous, you know. I mean, they didn't nominate Fred McMurray for Double Indemnity. How could they not? That was such a change for him, and he was so good in it.
He was fabulous.
And they should have nominated Edward G. Robinson for Best Supporting Actor.
I agree. He was so good. Edward G. Robinson never got one nomination, and he was so good. I loved him. Did you ever see Brother Orchid? It's a hoot.
Oh, God, yes.
And, you know, he's like, he's wearing the open-toed shoes, you know, the sandals, and he's getting a kick out of it. I just love him. And I do, talk about a noir. Scarlet Street.
Oh, God, yes. Scarlet Street, The Woman in the Window, The Red House. A wonderful little movie that he made called Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Did you ever see that?
Is that about somebody?
The clairvoyant?
Yes.
The clairvoyant, yeah.
It's based
on a novel by Cornell Woolrich. Cornell Woolrich, his books and stories made so many great films. You know, that's a strange guy. If you ever want to read a strange book, read about Cornell Woolrich. Oh, my God, what a strange story he had.
I love all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, so do I. I love noir. I love noir. I love Gloria Graham.
Adore Gloria Graham. Nobody has written a book about Gloria. They did years ago, and they're probably dead. And
did you see the movie out about her last year?
Yes.
Fabulous.
I was trying to get the guy who wrote the book.
For that is insane. Yeah. She was so good. That was so good. And, you know, Gloria Graham, oh, God, I had a great thing with her. The first movie I ever saw in a movie theater, my aunt came down, and I was like 5 years old, and she picked me up, and I had these red pajamas, footy pajamas on, and she put a coat on me. She said, I'm taking Stevie to the movies. And my mother said, you are? What are you going to go see? And they had done a re-release of The Greatest Show on Earth. She took me to see The Greatest Show on Earth. Well, I fell out of trees for the next 10 years thinking I was an aerialist. And I fell madly in love with Gloria Graham. Even then, as a kid, I thought she was the hottest thing I ever saw. And she was so flip and so, you know, just so kind of, you know, she's a wisecracker and gorgeous. Well, I guess it was 1981, around 81. No, it was earlier than that because she died in 81. It was around 79. They had a series one summer in New York of Radio City. Every Tuesday, they would show great films that had opened at the Music Hall, and they would try to get somebody from the film or related to the film to introduce it. And I read in the Post that Gloria Graham was going to introduce The Greatest Show on Earth. I raced down there, and she had just gotten done with the introduction when I got there, and we bumped right into each other because my eyes were adjusting to the darkness. She sat down next to this guy named Ted Hook, who ran this restaurant that they all used to go to called Ted Hook's on Stage, and I sat directly behind her, and I watched her watch The Greatest Show on Earth and comment on it. She was this, by that time, she was this tiny little willowy blonde. And up there on the screen, you know, as Angel, she was the redhead in Technicolor, you know. And so every time somebody would come on, like Charlton Heston came on, she leaned over to Ted Hook and she said, I loved him. I loved him. And then Jimmy Stewart came on. She leaned over. She said, "Oh, I loved him. He was great."
It's like she and was then, in.
And then
go on.
It came to the scene where the elephant had put its hoof over her face, and she turned and she said, "Oh, I can't swear on this, can I? Because it's a podcast. I can't use bad words, mm-hmm. can I?" She turned to
you
the
can.
Ted Hook and she's. Oh, she did. She said, "Do you know that fucker really made me do that?" And he said, "Why did you agree to do that?" She said, "Are you kidding? To be in a DeMille movie? And the only reason I got the part was because Lucille Ball got pregnant."
I love Gloria. She did so many wonderful performances, but it's so funny because it reminds me, you know, in It's a Wonderful Life as a little girl. And she said, "I like George." And Mary goes, "You like every boy. What's wrong with that?"
Yeah, really.
So Gloria Graham.
Well, Jimmy Stewart says, "What's your drink, Jane? I want some nice dress." "This whole thing, you only put it on, but I don't care how I look."
And the cop goes, "I think I'll go visit my wife."
Yeah, really, really.
That's a riot.
Yeah, Gloria Graham was just. And I love The Bad and the Beautiful. The Bad and the Beautiful is probably one of my top favorite
movies. I just watched it the other night.
Oh, my
Again.
God. James Lee, you have a very dirty mind. I'm happy to say.
She did great. She deserved that
oh,
Oscar.
So adorable. Oh, God. So adorable.
And with Poncho. And
oh, my God. She was so cute with dancing with Gilbert Rowland going, "I only danced with him twice."
I loved her. I just love her.
I did, too.
She was great in The Cobwebs. She was great in The Big Heat.
Oh,
you know what?
I love her in The Cobwebs. Oh, my God. Is she sumptuous in that movie or what? Holy
she
smoke.
Is
And having
sumptuous.
Her and Lillian Gish at odds with each other, what an unusual combination.
I know. I couldn't believe Lillian Gish was in that film, actually. Lauren McCall was in that as well, right? She was the the art teacher.
I've been talking to Mark Griffin about this, you know, because he also wrote a fabulous book about Vincente Minnelli. And everybody always talks about Minnelli and his musicals, but I really, really loved his melodramas. He had his melodramas are these all-star, you know, splashy melodramas, like very circuit. His book on Minnelli is called A Hundred or More Hidden Things. It's a fabulous book on Vincente Minnelli. And I loved The Cobweb. I loved 2 weeks in Another Town.
Oh, so did I. Sid Charisse playing such a slut. I love that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some Came Running. You know, I love all those big.
Oh, he directed.
Home from the Hill.
Love that movie.
Fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah.
George Hamilton, right? George Hamilton was also in 2 weeks from Another Town.
Yes,
right?
He was. Yeah. He didn't do bad in either one of those.
No, he didn't.
But I always. The Minnelli had a really interesting take on things. You know, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. They're fun to watch. They don't necessarily always work, but he took on really splashy, big. They were melodramas that were. They had everything but singing and dancing. They were like big. They were splashy, big, like musical melodramas. You know, they always had great scores and great casts. And, I just loved his stuff like that. I thought Tea and Sympathy. I love all those. I think they're great.
I'm going to get Mark's book because I want him on again. And I adored him. He was so great.
He's the best. Yeah, he's the best. And that book is fabulous on Mark Hudson. Both those books are great. Yeah, they're really, really good.
Jim, get me another one, will you? I don't want to miss the arrival.
How about you, Mrs. Taylor?
Well, I really shouldn't, but...
Excuse me.
If you see Carrie before I do, let me know. It'll be easier for her if I took them around.
Count on us, Sarah. You get a light bill.
I may need to.
Hold my drink, dear.
A gardener, why doesn't he find himself a decent money-making vocation?
You think material success is the only end worthy of pursuit of man?
Why, doctor, what's wrong with money?
I agree. You have to have it to have contempt for it.
Excuse me.
Thank you. Do you really think she'll have the nerve to come?
Oh, there they are now.
Oh, they're here.
Pardon me, Cops. I'm glad.
Just look at that car.
Just look at that man.
It's always the quiet ones, isn't it? But she's certainly the last person you'd expect.
Always pretending to be so prim. Proper.
Why, Howard, did she turn you down?
I'm so glad you could come. I'm Carrie's best friend. I'd like to be your friend, too.
Thank you.
Come on, darling. George?
Carrie, my favorite.
George,
woman.
How are you? Fine. I want you to know Ron Kirby.
Glad to meet you. You used to know your father. Fine man.
Thank you.
You know, I remember the
Shall
day
we
of...
say hello to Romeo and his Juliet? Come on, darling.
So that's Carrie's nature, boy.
You know the doctor, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, Carrie.
Carrie,
hello,
you know Miss Bisbee, Mr. Allenby.
Yes.
Mr. Kirby.
How do you do? How do you do?
You know, this was kind of supposed to be my party, but it looks like Mrs. Scott's getting all the attention. Of course, I guess it is more unusual when someone your age gets married. But I think your friend's awfully lucky. You see, no one in my family's had a dime since the Civil War. So, Tom won't get anything but poor little me. Don't bother, Carrie, shall we?
Carrie, my dear, what's this I hear about your... haven't I seen you somewhere before?
Well, Mrs. Humphrey, probably in your garden. I've been pruning your trees for the last 3 years.
Yes, of course. Sarah, I really must be going.
Excuse me, I'll be right back.
Come on into the bar. You've earned yourself a good, strong drink.
Go ahead, Ron.
I'll be right back.
All right. Howard.
Hi.
How are you?
Mona, Mark?
Hello.
Oh, my dear, he's fascinating. And that tan. I suppose from working outdoors. Of course, I'm sure he's handy indoors, too.
Mona sure got your number, Carrie. So have I.
Well, excuse me, Howard.
Guess you played me for a prize sucker that night at the club, huh, Carrie? Going into that perfect lady routine, making me apologize. If I'd known then what I know now, story sure would add a different ending.
Oh, Howard.
Never too late, huh, Carrie? Line forms to the right.
Howard, you're drunk.
Why, Carrie? Is one man enough for you?
Maybe you'd better stay right where you are.
What is it, Carrie?
Howard, of all people, I never would have believed it.
Believed what?
That Howard was the earthy type. Then you seem to attract that, Carrie.
Shall we go?
Yes.
Excuse us?
George, why, that man was positively murderous.
Did you see that, Fred?
What's the commotion?
Why, he might have killed poor Howard.